Okay, we wanted to take a minute to bring out a special guest and do a short segment with her. Our guest today is Sarah Catherine Gutierrez with Aptus Financial. And Aptus is perhaps the premier assisting firm for those who want to shift to do-it-yourself financial planning but don't feel like they're quite ready to do so. They've basically built a service that supports people on varying points of the DIY continuum. They actually believe that most people can DIY their finances, which not only lowers fees, but also gives a greater sense of control and perhaps even leads to better decisions and outcomes. They start with a comprehensive guided planning process for most clients, or just do a more limited review if you're experienced and more confident and just want to validate your plan. The cool thing about them is rather than have the usual number of clients that a financial planning firm has, which is perhaps 50 clients, they've done hundreds of financial plans for physicians. And so they're pretty well versed in their unique planning needs. Such as student loan repayment, cash flow prioritization, risk management, et cetera. And once you have a solid plan in place, they teach their clients to invest on their own or offer the option to invest for them if they feel ready to take it on themselves. And they just provide ongoing support and guidance in that situation. They have mostly flat fee pricing to help eliminate conflicts of interest and foster transparent, objective advice. Sarah Catherine has also been a speaker at WCICon Park City and WCICon Las Vegas. She's the author of a new book she has out called But First, Save 10%. And I'm excited to have her on the show here with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Dolly. It's such an honor to be on it.
Briefly, let's just talk a little bit about you and your firm. Why did you decide to be a financial advisor?
So I did not set out to be one. I thought I was going to be a stock analyst. That's what I was aspiring to be. And that's what I started my career in. And in fact, in college, I had interned for a stock analyst and thought that world of stock picking was pretty exciting. But as anyone can probably guess, the story of becoming a financial planner began when I started my career as a stock analyst in 2007. So if you can imagine trying to pick stocks starting in 2007, going to 08, 09, you can imagine what kind of wake-up call that was. And, you know, I just believe it was good divine intervention because in 08, 09, I was faced with this idea of how did all these people buy houses they couldn't afford? And that's really what, that was the question. That was what sparked an interest in becoming a financial planner. Because as you know, and I've spoken about at the conference, I've spoken about on a podcast in the past, if you look at how people get advice, for the most part, people are still getting financial advice from a sale. That's what can lead people to buying houses they can't afford en masse. That's how we still see doctors buying whole life policies and annuities that are just mostly inappropriate for them. And so that's what led to me becoming a financial planner. But more importantly, I didn't want to just become a financial planner doing things the way they had been done in the past. I wanted a financial planner who could give financial planning in a way that had no conflicts of interest. And then, interestingly enough, being a stock analyst, seeing that the efficient markets hypothesis probably is pretty true. It really is hard to beat the market. And at the same time, seeing the technological advancements and the, you know, mainstreaming of these passive mutual funds, I realized that I could actually be a financial planner, not have to sell products, not have to manage money, and instead just enable people to do it themselves, teach them how to do it.
Okay, so tell us about the fee structure for Aptus Financial. How's it work?
Yeah, so we have just flat fees based on our time planning. So we charge $250 an hour. So my partner, Tim Quillen, who's our CFO, when he came early on into the firm, what he realized is having an hourly model is fine, but what's better is if you can actually have a standard financial planning process. And that's what you had referred to earlier. So we have a financial planning process that is the bulk of what we do. It costs $3,000 to run a financial plan, and then it's $125 a month for us to help people implement the plan and then have an annual review. And during that process, we teach people, they open up their own accounts, we teach them to do their own management. That is the bulk of what we do. Now, when people have a little bit more complication, like they're pre-retirement or they own their own business, we have the flexibility to be able to expand that, to be able to do more work for them. And then, like you said before, too, people who have taken the Fire Your Financial Advisor course and they really have run their own financial plan. They don't need us to run another financial plan for them. So we do have the opportunity for people to bring in their financial plan. We look it over, we see if there are any holes in it, anything they've missed. And I think that's a nice little insurance policy for them that they haven't overlooked anything.
You also offer them the option for you to help them manage their investments as well.
Yes, this is a new offering and I'm really proud of it because, you know, what we have learned over the years is that some people just don't want to DIY. They don't want to manage their own money. So if they've got a couple million in assets, they're about to fire their advisor. They don't want those 2 million dumped into an account that they're responsible for yet. So what I'm proud about in our managed offering is that, again, we price it an hourly fee. It's a little bit higher because we do more work. But more importantly, we can actually help people. We can kind of demystify the investing process, and we want people to move from us managing it to not managing it. So we do have a fiduciary 10 basis point, 0.1% AUM fee. But importantly, we want to have no conflicts of interest in our managed offering. So that fee does not go to the advisor. Instead, the advisor is only paid on the flat fee because we want them incentivized to continuously encourage the client to move from managed offering to a DIY.
It goes to the firm rather than the individual advisor then.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And I think you've probably already explained what's unique about your firm, but is there anything else you want to add about that?
Oh my gosh, I'll tell you, it is the people. I mean, it is the people who work at Aptus, the financial planners themselves. So like if you look at Matt Duncan, he is a CFA, a chartered financial analyst. That is one of the toughest certifications out there. So I have a CFP, which is pretty hard, but a CFA, I mean, it's just a totally different category. 2 decades as a stock analyst, I still can listen to him explain to people an investment policy and seeing the care and concern he has for the client to not just say, okay, here's our strategy, but really wanting them to understand it at an elemental level. I just could not be prouder of having someone with that kind of passion for education that's a planner. Or Denise Chai, 20 years as a stock analyst for Bank of America in Hong Kong, Singapore, and the US. You know, she retired early in her late 40s, lives the mission of so many people who are coming in to Aptus through White Coat Investor who want to set these audacious, huge financial goals and then be shepherded by somebody who has lived them successfully. You know, she had retired. She was running a reading program for prisoners, reading to their children, and basically saw the passion and saw the dedication to doing something completely different that could have a positive change in the financial industry at Aptus. And we're just incredibly lucky that she came on. So I think about Tim and Matt and Denise and what we're trying to accomplish at Aptus. And I think that is actually what makes us more unique than even any pricing.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that. Will you stick around and answer a few questions from listeners with me?
I would love to. Yes.
Awesome. Let's take one off the speak pipe from Phil.
Dr. Dolly, thanks for all that you do. My entire financial literacy is thanks to you and your podcast and your blog. I really appreciate it. My question involves defined benefit plans, which is something I haven't heard you talk much about. So I was wondering if you could give me your thoughts. My situation is that I'm early in my career, my mid-30s. I work at one of the traditional large academic state university hospitals. While no one can know for certain, I've developed a niche in emergency medicine and hope to stay on as faculty for the next 20 to 30 years. My main retirement account is a defined benefit plan in which I receive 14% and is actually part of the state teacher's retirement system. Luckily, my institution also offers a pre-tax 403B and 457 accounts, which I max out, along with my backdoor Roth and other taxable brokerage accounts. My financial plan states that I should have an 80-20 stock-to-bond ratio this early in my career due to the ability to tolerate risk and volatility. My question is, when it comes to asset allocation, how should I look at my defined benefit plan? Should I try to do research in the plan's asset allocation or simply invest as if it didn't exist? Should I plan on being more aggressive with my other accounts? Any help you could provide would be very much appreciated. Thank you again.
All right. So Phil's trying to figure out how to look at his defined benefit plan for asset allocation purposes. What would you tell him?
Yeah. So it's a really great concept. And it's especially helpful if you are nearing or you can see the light of your work optional days. If you're early in your career, you know, we have had actually quite a bit of defined benefit come through the office. But here's the thing, you don't know the actuarial assumptions are going to hold for a really long time. And earlier on in your career, you don't know that you're actually going to be there long enough to actually see the benefit of that program. So I would not touch an asset allocation in any different way if this is an early career, even with the large defined benefit as part of your retirement. As you get closer, however, and you can actually see what kind of income benefit, you can actually calculate the income benefit in your retirement assumption and be able to back into, you know, what your asset allocation is, considering that you're not going to have to save as much because you have that defined benefit that's going to be rolling through. And so for that reason, we can make a case that more towards your mid or later career that you could have, you know, potentially a more aggressive asset allocation, you know, have a little bit more stocks than you would otherwise at that stage.
Yeah, I couldn't quite tell from his question whether it was a true pension or whether it was a defined benefit plan, but it sounded like a true pension to me. So I agree you should ignore that for your asset allocation purposes and just use it to decrease how much income you need in retirement. But if it's more of a cash balance plan that's eventually going to be rolled into a 401k, you can usually figure out what the asset allocation in it is. And you could add that to your asset allocation overall if you want. I'm in that situation, but I don't bother. I just ignore mine as far as my asset allocation goes because it's a relatively tiny amount of my overall investment assets. And plus, every few years, we seem to roll it over into our 401ks for some IRS-approved reason. And so at that point, I start counting it, but not before then. But a lot of people ask about their pensions and about Social Security. How does this go into my asset allocation? And I agree with you. Just leave it out. All right, let's take one from Andy in the Midwest off the SpeakPipe.
Thanks for all that you do. This is Andy in the Midwest, and I'm in a 10-person specialty group. I've been practicing for 7 years, and now I'm a full partner. Business has been going well, but there's some concern about sustainability with some aging partners and trouble recruiting new physicians. We've been approached by a private equity firm that wants to buy our practice and make us, quote, more efficient to streamline the process, but take control of our businesses. My older partners think that this is a good time to sell at a high point and get guaranteed in the future, while I kind of look at it as giving up control and maybe hedging our bets when we're doing so well currently. We've seen other groups in the area get smaller, not able to recruit, and end up being bought out by a hospital. I just am not sure how to go forward. I've never been in this situation. I didn't know if you had any advice about private equity firms or red flags to watch out for, but any advice would be appreciated. Thanks.
Okay. This is a more and more common situation all the time. PE firm comes in, we want to buy the practice, and the older docs want to go for it. Of course, they want to cash out. And the younger docs are like, wait, I thought I joined a partnership. I want to own my business. I don't want to lose this control. What do you tell Andy?
Yeah, this is a tough one. And I actually have more questions probably than answers on this one. You know, Denise in our firm has seen, she was a retail analyst. So she's seen quite a bit of the impact of, you know, private equity on businesses. And one of the biggest dangers, you know, aside from any kind of financial impact it can have on a younger doc in there is, you know, the work environment. I mean, it can, with all the cost cutting measures, I mean, that can be a not very fun place to work. So we have actually seen recently a client come through here who was able to negotiate a nice ownership stake. So not a majority, not close to a majority, but enough where this physician is reaping the benefits of the profits from this buyout. So, you know, if that's a possibility to negotiate a 15 or a 20% stake, at least you have some kind of benefit from it. If you can't talk the older physicians out of, you know, selling to a private equity firm.
Yeah. I mean, I just think what would happen if I were in this situation, you know, if somebody was coming to me and saying, we're going to give you a big lump sum of cash for your practice, I might take it, right? I'm far enough along in my career. I might take that money, but I'm not going to keep working for them afterward. You know, I'm out, I'm done. Because I really like being an owner. I really like having that control over my practice. And even if it cost me something, I would probably still maintain ownership of the practice, because I like being able to select who I work with, being able to hire and fire staff, being able to decide how the holidays are split up and the calls split up and the money split up. That's one of the best parts for me of being in my group. And I know the first few years out of residency, that didn't matter to me that much. I was much more excited just to be working shifts and seeing cool diseases and taking care of people. But by the time I was 5 years out, that was really important to me to have that control over my practice. So give that up at your own peril, you know, knowing that it will probably get more important to you as your career goes on. But I think a lot of docs in these situations, they're just outvoted. They don't have a choice. So you might as well get what you can out of it. And then, you know, if you stay there, if you're happy, go ahead and stay. If you're not happy, well, start looking around, see what other situations you can get into.
And I might add one more thing too. I think that if you have any control over which private equity firm as well, that can make a difference. So the larger ones, you're really going to have very little power, even if you still retain some ownership. But some of these smaller private equity firms would probably see you more as a partner. And so, you know, you could probably maybe influence a decision closer to that to have a little bit more autonomy.
Yeah. All right, let's take our last one here from David off the speak pipe. And this sounds like a simple question, but I think there's a lot that goes into this question. So let's take a listen.
Hi, Dr. Dolly. My name is David. I had a question about dividend stock investing. Is it best done in a Roth account so as to avoid, or rather not have to pay taxes on all the dividends that get paid out to you? This is not a question of whether you believe in dividend stocks or not, but rather where I should keep them if I decide to go in that direction. Thank you.
All right. Sounds very simple. Should I do dividend stock investing in a Roth IRA or elsewhere? What do you tell this person if you were a client?
Asset location. Okay. So first of all, you know, we're not getting into a discussion on, you know, whether we want to pick, a dividend stock fund. So we're not, that's
well,
not the
maybe we question. Should, right? He doesn't want to talk about it, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about it.
I'm respecting his decision to not talk about it. So he's asking specifically where to put it. And so, you know, I will say, you know, we have done the asset location with clients in the past, and I think that it is, you know, potentially a good strategy for people who are true optimizers. And this, and I mean, he sounds like a true optimizer here. And so this could be potentially great, but the risk of this is that you can get your portfolio really out of whack. And so that is what we found with folks who didn't want to stay on top of it, you know, pretty routinely. So here's the thing with a dividend fund like this, the issue with that in a Roth is it's a little bit of a wasted opportunity, because you would prefer to have your faster growing stocks in a Roth account if you were going to optimize so that it can be essentially in this tax exempt account and zoom up and not have to pay taxes. And you want the zoomier stuff in that kind of an account. So preferably, we would want something like that more in just a tax-deferred account, like your 401k or 403b. But there's probably a reason he didn't say that. It's because it's probably not in his list of, you know, menu of options in those accounts. And so if he's following the white coat investor advice and following the tax-efficient waterfall that we recommend and doing backdoor Roths, then that is probably the only other place between tax exempt and tax deferred to put it. So, you know, it's fine, but we would, you know, probably put the more value oriented stocks, dividend stocks, in tax deferred, and the more growthy stocks into a Roth if we had a perfect world.
I'm not even sure he's talking about a fund. I think he might be talking about individual stocks.
I'm definitely not going to go there. So we really believe that simple wins every time. So if you want to ask, you know, what we believe, remember, we are former stock analysts, every single one of us. That's what we did for a living. We tried to pick the winners. And so we uniquely have, you know, an outlook on this investing world. It's not just a buzzword for us to do passive. Like, we've lived that world. We've been in the belly of the beast, and we are here to tell you the market simply is too efficient to beat, and simpler is going to win. And so we think a simple allocation with simple passive funds, with as simple a strategy to be able to maintain it as possible, is going to be a winning strategy for most people.
Yeah. I mean, I got a lot to say about this question, right? I mean, first of all, if we're talking about individual stock investing, I'm not a big fan of that, because I think you're taking on uncompensated risk. if you're going to do it, which it doesn't sound like we're going to be able to talk David out of doing it, whatever it is he's wanting to do, a Roth IRA is not a terrible place to do it in that there are no transaction costs. You know, you can probably go to a brokerage where you get 100 free trades or something. So you're not paying the trade fees. You do have the bid-ask spreads, of course, and there are no tax consequences, assuming you're making money. So it's not a terrible place if you're going to try to pick stocks. I just don't think you ought to be trying to pick stocks at all, whether they're dividend stocks or growth stocks or anything else. Yes, a dividend stock that's kicking out big dividends compared to Berkshire Hathaway is going to be less tax efficient. So, you know, that's why you might try doing that inside a tax protected account of some kind rather than your taxable account if you insist on doing it. So I can see why you'd be motivated to do that. But I think in what I've found in my portfolio is, especially as my taxable account grows, that tax protected space is becoming so precious to me now, because there are some asset classes I really don't want to hold in taxable. Things like TIPS, where you have to worry about the phantom income issue, real estate investment trusts, which are so tax inefficient because they got to pay out 90% of their profits each year in what's basically qualifies only at ordinary income tax rates. You know, things like that are so tax inefficient. When you look at everything on the spectrum, dividend stocks aren't the least tax efficient thing around. They're fairly efficient because they're stocks, even though they're less efficient than a growth stock might be. So I wouldn't necessarily feel like it has to go in a Roth IRA for that reason. It really depends on what else you have in your portfolio. If this is just play money for you, if it's a little bit of money where you're like, I want to try picking stocks, do it in taxable. Don't play with your serious money. Go take your $5,000 or $10,000 in taxable and pick stocks with it if you want to. And, you know, if you want to have a dividend focus on that, knock yourself out. The fun thing about that is a lot of these dividend focused people are really interested in, you know, income to help them live right now that they can spend right now. And obviously, if you're getting that in a Roth IRA, that's not going to work out very well. So you need to do it in taxable account for that purpose. But I think we just don't have enough information to really answer this question, which is sit down and make a whole written financial plan for this person. And we just don't have enough information to answer it. So good question, David. Thanks for calling in. Well, Sarah Catherine, it's been good having you on. I appreciate all you do for White Coat Investors. And obviously, thanks for coming out and speaking with us at our conferences. And good luck with the new book. It's really an exciting opportunity to write a book, but it's a lot of work too. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. And it's such an honor to be on here.
If you want to learn more about Sarah Catherine and her firm, you can go to aptusfinancial.com and you can sign up for an appointment, get a second opinion on your portfolio, or get started getting a written financial plan in place today.